Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics podcast, and welcome to the start of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry. I'm Galen Druk. We're planning on recording podcasts covering the impeachment hearings each day, kind of as they happen. So get ready for a lot of podcasts. We'll see if we can keep up with the pace. But today we heard from acting U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, and the senior diplomat who oversees Ukraine policy, George Kent. They testified together in a hearing that lasted about 5.5 hours. They described U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine generally and the specific events that led them to believe that President Trump was leveraging U.S. military aid and a White House meeting to try to get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. So we're going to dig into the details from today's hearings. And here with me to do that, our managing editor, Micah Cohen. How's it going, Micah?
Very good. Hi, Galen.
Hey. And also here with us from Chicago is senior writer Amelia Thompson DeVoe, who also covers the law for us at 538. Welcome to the podcast. Good to have you back on.
Yeah, thanks, Galen. Great to be here.
It's been a minute since Mueller talk, but we've got a whole other legal conundrum to dig apart at this point. So we're glad to have you. And let's start with you, Amelia. What is your top line takeaway from the hearing today?
I mean, at the risk of kind of immediately diving on the one new piece of information that came out of today's hearings, I do think one really significant development is that there is another witness who is going into a closed-door deposition on Friday. He's an aide to Taylor, and Taylor had testified that a new piece of information came out in conversation with these staffers about a conversation that the staffer had overheard with Trump about some of these investigations. So I think that's a really significant piece of information. It also happens to be currently leading the New York Times homepage right now. So I think that's the thing that kind of the media is going to latch onto as one of the significant things that came out. But in general, you know, I think Democrats kind of did what they promised they were going to do, which is that they're sort of soberly laying out this evidence. They had two witnesses who I think were both pretty successful at telling the story of the Ukraine saga as they saw it. I would say I think Taylor is probably a little bit better of a storyteller and was a little bit more compelling in the way he talked, but they were both fairly effective. And it seems like Democrats are, you know, really just trying to lay out this massive amount of evidence that they've gathered. And then, of course, what we saw from Republicans was really digging in and throwing a number of different defenses of Trump at the witnesses.
And we're going to dig into those defenses a little bit more. But Micah, what was your top line takeaway?
Yeah, Amelia kind of hit it there at the end. To me, the big takeaway here was the calm, sober tone of the hearings in general, especially on the part of Schiff, the chairman, and Democrats. If you're in the White House or you're on the GOP side of the aisle, you want this inquiry to be viewed as partisan and nothing more. And so the more that the hearings and the investigation are calm and fact-driven and sober, I think the better it is for Democrats. And I think at least on day one, for the most part, they passed that test.
I mean, in fact, on the Republican side as well, there could have been much more of a circus, right? They could have tried to shut down the hearings or something like that. And there was some back and forth and pauses in the hearings along the way, but there was nothing super dramatic, any attempts to shut things down or walk out or anything like that.
There weren't too many big stunts. There was a little bit of like parliamentary maneuvering that delayed things by like 2 minutes. But yeah, nothing really beyond that. You know, there was this really interesting moment during the Nixon impeachment inquiry where somebody in the White House was, I forget who said this, but they were kind of lamenting the erosion in Nixon support and referring to the televised judiciary hearings at the time, he said, you know, the crazies didn't act crazy. Essentially like, okay, people are tuning in and expecting, at least some people expecting to see, oh, partisan Democrats are witch hunt and, you know, they don't have torches. They're not burning anyone at the stake. I think that largely helps Democrats' case. And because, as Amelia was saying, we already knew a lot of the facts that Taylor and Kent were going to lay out, to me, that was the big takeaway, just the soberness of it.
Yeah, and And I mean, Republicans also, you know, they didn't really, I think, undermine the credibility of Taylor or Kent. You know, there were certainly moments when Taylor and Kent seemed a little confused by questions that Republicans were asking, or they even seemed a little bit skeptical of the questions, maybe a little even dismissive of the questions. But I think Taylor and Kent came out of this looking good and sort of like the kind of credible, legitimate, nonpartisan diplomats that they went into the hearing looking like. And I think that's a big victory for Democrats, because I was frankly expecting Republicans to maybe try to hammer them a little bit more. And certainly there were some attempts to sort of say, you know, oh, you guys don't really know what you're talking about. You heard your information secondhand or third hand. But for the most part, I don't think that really penetrated.
And it's worth saying here that William Taylor is the current acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. So he serves at the pleasure of the president currently and went out of his way, along with Kent, on multiple occasions to say, I'm a nonpartisan actor here. I'm just executing U.S. foreign policy, et cetera.
No, and you know, there were moments where, in a narrow way, that played to Democrats' disadvantage. You know, there were a few moments where there was a moment with Swalwell, with a couple other Democratic representatives.
And where, Castro,
where they like were clearly trying to tee Kent or Taylor up for like a pithy, damning quote.
This is illegal.
Exactly, basically. Right. And both Taylor and Kent would not play ball, either by answering, and like Kent in particular was like a master of a like bureaucratic language. So you're like, wait, what did he say? And Taylor would just say, listen, I'm here to tell you the facts as I know them, nothing beyond that. And so while Democrats didn't get like that soundbite bumper sticker, it does serve their purposes in a larger sense.
Although the one moment that got the closest to that is when Swalwell said, you described this quid pro quo situation as crazy. Would you also describe it as wrong? And he kind of hesitated for a second, like, do I take the bait? This is Taylor. And then he said, yes, I would describe it as wrong. And then went into further detail. Amelia, you brought up the fact that we did learn some new information today. So can we get into a little bit more of the details of what that new witness heard and what it kind of gets at in the case?
Yeah, so it was really interesting when Taylor's opening statement came out. You know, a lot of it was actually literally things we had seen before in his opening statement in the closed door deposition. But there was this little new piece of information, which is that Taylor had learned from this staffer that while he was actually out at the battlefront in Ukraine, the staffer had been with Sondland, Gordon Sondland, who's the ambassador to the EU and is noteworthy in all of this because he is the only witness currently who has talked about a direct link between these investigations and Trump. And he's going to be testifying next week. And presumably that's going to be a pretty big day of testimony. But this staffer overheard a phone call between Sondland and Trump where Trump was asking about the investigations. And Sondland said basically that, you know, the Ukrainians are ready to go. And then after the phone call, this is all according to Taylor's opening statement, the staffer had asked Sondland, hey, what does Trump think about Ukraine? And Sondland said, oh, you know, what Trump really cares about are these investigations into the Bidens. And so I have to say, when I first saw that in Taylor's opening statement, I thought, you know, wow, that could be really significant. But like, really, this would be significant if we heard it from the staffer, because one of the criticisms that we heard over and over and over again today in the hearing is, well, Taylor and Kent didn't talk to the president. They don't know what's in the president's mind. You know, they can't draw this direct connection between the investigations and Trump. And so, you know, to hear this filtered through Taylor, it seems like, okay, this is potentially big, but also, you know, it's going to get subjected to that kind of criticism. But then it came out that this staffer, David Holmes, is apparently going to give a closed-door deposition on Friday. And so it seems conceivable that, you know, we could see the transcript of his deposition eventually. He might even testify publicly. And that's a big deal just because of how few of the witnesses sort of have testimony that directly bears on Trump's role here. You know, there's a ton of circumstantial evidence, and we heard a lot of that today. But the more people who can speak to Trump actually being connected to the call for the investigations and wanting the investigations, that's very good for the Democrats. So I think that was a fairly significant thing to come out of today's hearings.
Yeah. So can we talk about this for a second? I was a little flummoxed by this particular GOP line of defense. I actually thought Republicans, you know, the facts really aren't on their side here as we know them. And I thought I thought they had a couple pretty successful lines of defense. One was Trump was worried about Ukraine election interference argument. Amelia said this before, just because it's so hard to prove motive. I think that's at least sort of like rhetorically useful, right? And then another line of defense that they used that Amelia was just getting at was all this is hearsay. None of you saw what Trump did or knew what Trump did firsthand. That kind of works today. But as Amelia just said, you know, when the staffer testifies, when Sondland eventually testifies, isn't that defense going to fall apart? I guess we don't know what Sondland will say. Well, we kind of do, don't we? He already sort of said he thinks there was a quid pro quo. So I don't know. What, Amelia, what did you make of that?
Well, so I think there is, you know, if you're a Republican, I think you do have potentially reason to think that Sondland, you know, what he's saying is definitely not good for Trump. He's not the kind of star witness that Taylor and Kent are, in that he has not seemed incredibly eager to throw the Trump administration under the bus. I mean, he had to come back and amend his testimony to say that he sort of did communicate to the Ukrainians that the aid was probably not going to be released unless they publicly committed to the investigations, after having initially not said that in his first round of testimony. So, you know, this is a guy who hasn't seemed super willing to, you know, really like cooperate with the Democrats and give the Democrats what they want. But in a bigger sense, I do think it is a short-sighted strategy insofar as it relies on not having more witnesses come out, like potentially this staffer who can talk to, you know, Trump actually calling for these investigations.
When it comes to the new news that we learned about today vis-a-vis the staffer overhearing Trump's conversation with Sondland on the telephone, how much does it matter whether or not these hearings make news, in the sense that this is a new piece of evidence that we didn't hear before, versus how much of it is relitigating things that have either already been leaked to the press or came out because they already released the transcripts of the depositions?
Well, that's kind of a tough question to answer. On the one hand, you might say, just given the kind of inherent incentives of the media, that the more these hearings can make news, new news, that needs to happen for them to really break through, be successful, and potentially change public opinion. You know, we were getting at this before. Big headline on the Washington Post right now: new testimony ties Trump more directly to Ukraine pressure. Right? That's a reference to the new news that came out of today. New York Times: impeachment witness cites new evidence of Trump pressure campaign on Ukraine. So I do think the more new things we learn during these hearings, the more impactful the hearings are likely to be, all else being equal. But even if this new bit of evidence hadn't come out, I still think most media outlets would be leading with some headline really big about the hearings. What would that headline say in the absence of this new evidence? That I'm not sure, but it probably wouldn't be great for Trump still. So I don't know. It's a tricky line.
As someone who has been kind of immersed in all of these depositions from the closed door testimony, I didn't hear a lot today that was new to me, but I would imagine that most people have not kind of waded into the thousands of pages that the Democrats have released over the past week. And I would imagine, you know, if you're just tuning in and watching this and you're not that familiar with the background, that a lot of what you would hear, you know, absent the new stuff, would still, you know, potentially be pretty shocking.
And that's actually a great point and something we don't know yet. But like, how many people tuned into impeachment today for the first time? Or how many people will tune into impeachment over the next couple weeks for the first time? We don't really know that yet. And I think that's something that'll be interesting to watch.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the content of the hearing today. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, at netsuite.com/538. That's netsuite.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/538. All right, we're back, and I want to dig into the arguments that we heard from Democrats and Republicans today. And I'll put this to you, Amelia. According to the Constitution, right, this is what we're going off of in all of these hearings. The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. We've probably heard that before. We've talked about it before on this podcast. Did Democrats do anything today to prove that there was treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, I mean, the first thing I think is it's not clear what a high crime and misdemeanor necessarily is. So, you know, do I think Democrats have started laying out a case for specific impeachable offenses? No, not really. And that's probably not something that's going to happen in a kind of concerted way until we get to the Judiciary Committee, which will actually be drafting the articles of impeachment. But do I think Democrats started sort of laying out a case that Trump was behind this foreign policy push, you know, that was going to benefit him politically and was counter to the interests of the United States? Yes, the Democrats definitely started to make that case through Kent and Taylor's testimony. You know, that's obviously going to be really key, whether this turns into an impeachment article that is abuse of power or bribery or extortion. You know, the Democrats seem to be kind of moving away from using the specific words quid pro quo, and they're kind of trying to use more colloquial language. But it's all sort of, you know, it's all sort of the same nexus of stuff, like this idea that Trump is the president. He's supposed to be doing things that advance the national interest. The Democrats' case is he was bending through Giuliani and other people the mechanism of the U.S. government to help him politically in a way that hurt the country and hurt the U.S. interest by hurting Ukraine, which was this vulnerable country that was in need of U.S. security aid and sort of is this important bulwark against Russia in Europe. You know, that's the case that Democrats have to be making, and they definitely started to do that today.
Micah, we know from looking at polling that Americans in general, Republicans and Democrats alike, don't care that much about foreign policy. So did Democrats frame their arguments today in foreign policy terms primarily, or was it more about like corruption or national security? And do you think that will make a difference in the end?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think it was mostly foreign policy. There was a lot of talk about the kind of perilous position these actions put Ukraine in and just everything from a foreign policy standpoint that was riding on that. And therefore, these actions were wrong. Like that was the kind of implicit push behind what Democrats and largely what Taylor and Kent were saying. I tend not to think most Americans make their minds up about political issues in that way, where it's like, oh, I don't care about foreign policy, and therefore this alleged crime or alleged improper behavior, because it involves foreign policy, I don't care about. I think Americans care about abuse of power, whether that abuse of power has to do with domestic issues or foreign policy issues, I think is secondary. And it's more like, what was the abuse of power? What is the evidence for it? And you get what I mean? Like, it's not like a 1+1=2. It's more just like a kind of holistic impressionistic.
Although on the live blog, I think at the beginning, we were saying this is very foreign policy heavy. He's rooting this in the Cold War and talking about U.S. policy towards Russia long term, U.S. policy towards Ukraine long term. Are they framing it as this president like uniquely did something corrupt? And that's what this case hinges on versus like, did we put Ukraine in a vulnerable position? Because maybe Americans don't care whether or not Ukraine is in a vulnerable position.
See, I think, I mean, I'm curious what Amelia thinks, but I think the here are all the really bad foreign policy implications of these maneuvers is necessary because in order to care about the abuse of power, you have to feel like it's serious and that it had bad repercussions, right? But that's about it. You know, it's not like Americans really have to care about the future of Ukraine to care about abuse of power. Do I think that like all the Democrats who support impeachment now are like really, really concerned about the future of Ukraine? No, not really. Right, Amelia? Like it's more like a threshold issue than like a right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why I think Taylor was a more effective witness than Kent was in a lot of ways, because Kent was the one where during the live blog, you know, Kent, he starts with this opening statement that's, you know, all about geopolitical history. And I was just like, oh, man, if this is what this hearing is going to be, then Democrats have really stepped in it. And then Taylor started talking and he was just sort of laying things out much more clearly. And I do think you're right, Micah, that to sort of understand why Democrats think what Trump did is an abuse of power, you have to understand Trump's relationship with the president of Ukraine is not a relationship between equals. Ukraine is a much weaker country than we are, and they're a country at war with a very powerful adversary, and they really wanted the security assistance. And Zelensky also is this new leader who really could have used the boost and the legitimacy and the credibility that would have come from a White House meeting with Trump. And sort of when you start to understand that backstory, I think for someone who, you know, doesn't think about diplomacy, doesn't really understand sort of U.S. relationships, it might kind of seem like, well, you know, maybe this is just how these things work. Maybe this is just leverage and, you know, that's how diplomacy is. And so I think to sort of have people understand, like, first of all, from career diplomats, like, no, this isn't normal. It is not normal for the president of the United States to condition security aid on an investigation of a political rival. That's something a lot of career diplomats have said so far, but I think is like an important sort of, again, threshold thing. And then to really emphasize why this was such a tough situation for Ukraine and why, you know, if all of this stuff happened, it really was Trump and his allies taking advantage of this vulnerable ally of the U.S. And so I think all of that is necessary. I don't see how the Democrats get around talking about that and making all of it clear, but you do have to talk about it in very kind of simple and vivid language. And I think Taylor in general was better at doing that than Kent.
Yeah, you need voters to think, oh, Trump abused his power here and had bad foreign policy repercussions. You don't need voters to think, oh my God, this affected the future of Ukraine in X, Y, and Z ways, right? You just need them to have that sort of impressionistic, oh, this had serious consequences, and that's it.
But also, the situation that you laid out there, Amelia, sounds like Democrats have to do a decent amount of work to bring the public along with them as they tell the story about why Ukraine is significant, why Russia is significant, et cetera. So what did Republicans do to try to undermine that? What was that? We talked about one response from Republicans today. What were some of the others?
Yeah, so another one that we heard a fair amount about was this idea of, well, you know, Trump actually may have had legitimate reasons for wanting the Ukraine to investigate 2016 election interference or to investigate Hunter Biden's presence on this Ukrainian energy company's board, and sort of drilling into some of Trump's potential justifications there. And they did that for a while. I think the challenge with that is that on the one hand, as I think I've said and written, you know, I think, frankly, for Republicans, the closer they can get to something like, oh, Trump had good intentions and he was trying to go after corruption, you know, I think like when you see the evidence for that, it's not good, but it is harder to prove what was happening, sort of like what Trump's intentions were. So that seems like it's just potentially harder for Democrats to argue against. On the other hand, to make these arguments about Ukraine having, potentially interfered in the 2016 election, you know, that's a conspiracy theory that is pretty much unproven. And you kind of have to go pretty far down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole in order to make that case. And that was one thing that I think, you know, was especially difficult for the Republican staffer who led off their questioning. He was just really hard to follow at many points. But I think also, you know, even for someone like Devin Nunes, you know, if you were really up with these conspiracy yeah. theories, then like what they're saying makes a lot of sense. If you don't have that background, I think it can be just totally illegible.
Yeah, that there was a ton of that, a ton of like just invoking these buzzwords from Fox News or Breitbart conspiracy theories. And as Amelia says, if you're not eyeball deep in that stuff, you're sort of like, wait, what? The more like generic and maybe workable defense, which doesn't actually make sense, but at least kind of rhetorically works, is Ukraine never announced an investigation of the Bidens, and the military aid was given to them. I thought Republicans were pretty successful in, for example, comparing the Trump administration's record of helping Ukraine versus Obama's, right? Because there were real differences in how far the Trump administration has gone.
The line was Obama gave Ukraine blankets and Trump gave Ukraine Javelin defense missiles,
right,
et cetera,
guns,
that
right.
can, guns that can blow up tanks, et cetera.
Exactly. And so that at least rhetorically is, it sounds good, right? I can imagine someone's conservative uncle saying to them at the dinner table, listen, there was no investigation. The aide got there. What's the big deal?
An attempted quid pro quo is not a quid pro quo.
Right, right. And like, maybe they wouldn't say it that way, but yeah.
I think it would just be like, you don't have, like, I think that sort of fits more into this, like, you don't have proof that this was a serious quid pro quo, which, you know, sorry to interrupt, Michael, but yeah. I think this fits into another, like, line of defense that we heard today, which I know is a little harder for Democrats to argue against, is sort of like Zelensky himself said this wasn't a quid pro quo. And the Ukrainians, you know, they're not out there complaining about this and saying that Trump did a bad thing. So, you know, Trump didn't do a bad thing. And obviously, there are many, many reasons why Zelensky would not want to crater his relationship with the president of the United States by saying publicly that he was pressured. You know, he felt there was a quid pro quo, and that probably wouldn't make him look great at home either. But, you know, I think that sort of fits into that broader argument of the aid got released and, you know, everyone's happy now. And the Ukrainians were never, you know, unhappy about this. They never complained about this to begin with.
The other comparison that they drew with the Obama administration was with Biden himself saying, well, Biden wanted to condition aid on their prosecutor investigating corruption. That's the exact same thing that Trump wanted to do.
Yeah, there are a ton of GOP lines like that, which sound reasonable for about a split, like half a second. And then you think, oh, Biden was doing that in exchange for legitimate U.S. policy reasons. Trump was doing that in exchange for personal political reasons. And then it falls apart, right? But there are like a lot of GOP lines like that sound good for a moment. Hey, there was no investigation and the aid was released. Okay, great. Well, the aid was released 2 days after the House got wind of the whistleblower complaint. Are those connected? Well, we don't really know. But like, there are a ton of lines like that sound good for a moment, and then you think about it, or if you know the full fact pattern, they fall apart. Do Americans know the full fact pattern? We'll have to wait and
see. I'm sure a lot of Americans don't.
No, right. Yeah, exactly. So it's more like the media knows the full fact pattern. So it's like I tend to think more than like the kind of like how good rhetorically is this argument made in the moment, in the hearing, is less important than what is the general thrust of the coverage of these hearings? What is the general tenor of each side in these hearings? That's, I think, what will determine which way this goes.
And Amelia, I know that you have written about this. So could you tell us just a little bit about what it would actually take to change public opinion through holding these kinds of investigatory hearings?
Yes, there's been political science research on this, just the extent to which congressional hearings can erode public support for the president. And the political scientists, Eric Schickler and Doug Kreiner, who have done this research, have shown that in the past, lots of congressional hearings, you know, really did seem to have the power to erode a president's approval rating, sometimes quite significantly. The big caveat being that, you know, Trump's approval rating is just much steadier than previous presidents, and Democrats' attempts to investigate him so far haven't really had that impact. So I think, you know, all of this with a caveat that Trump may be different. But I do think there is an important lesson from this research, just in that it's kind of less important, as Micah was saying, to fixate on, you know, what are the bombshells that came out of this individual hearing, sort of who had the best sound bites, and more to sort of take a step back and say, okay, you know, are these hearings continuing to get media coverage? Are people still paying attention to them? What are the general lines and narratives that are coming out of them that are sort of sticking and staying in the coverage and, you know, potentially staying in people's minds? Because at least in the past, it hasn't been, you know, a single day of blockbuster testimony that has suddenly changed the way the American public thinks about a president. It's been sort of this sustained drumbeat of negative attention that has hurt presidents. And so, you know, I think it's going to be more important rather than saying, oh, did this particular hearing seem to shift public opinion? You know, I think it's going to be a cumulative impact if there is one.
And it's worth saying that 538 with Ipsos is actually going to be tracking public opinion as these hearings go forward to see if an accumulation of public hearings does change public sentiment about the president, about impeachment, removal, the inquiry overall. So we'll come back to that throughout our coverage. As we wrap up here, I have two final questions. One is, first of all, what comes next? What can we expect over the next 2 weeks, Amelia?
So the Democrats last night announced a bunch more hearings. So there will be one hearing on Friday with former ambassador to the Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. And then next week, there are going to be, I believe, six hearing sessions, but with eight witnesses. And then there may be more hearings after that. So it's going to be a lot more of today coming up, at least in the next week and possibly in the next couple of weeks before even this phase of the impeachment inquiry is over.
Oh, boy. And we also have a debate next week. But the other thing that I wanted to ask about is actually not related to impeachment, but something that we want to cover before we go. So, Micah, it looks like Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, is joining the Democratic primary race. You lose, you know, you lose a couple candidates in the race.
Gain one back. Yeah.
So what is the abridged version of Deval Patrick's theory of the case for how he would become the Democratic nominee?
Oh, God. Okay. So I think his theory is something like, I can give you Biden, but younger, Buttigieg, but older, Warren, but safer in the general election. You know, we are seeing, I think, among Democratic elites and Democratic donors, this agita around the current crop of top-tier Democrats.
So that was like a great use of agita, by the way.
It is, though. That is what it is. Yeah. It's like, you know, okay, so like Biden, Warren, Buttigieg, Sanders. Reportedly, Democratic donors, at least some Democratic donors, believe that Biden is too weak, essentially, electorally. Maybe his age is an issue. His fundraising hasn't been that impressive. Warren is too far left to win a general election. And Buttigieg is, you know, young and inexperienced, right? So, and like Sanders obviously is too far left too from these donors' point of view. And so what you're seeing is, I think, enough of these donors feel this way that they're talking amongst themselves and pushing Deval Patrick. We've seen reports of Michael Bloomberg. We've seen reports of Eric Holder.
We've seen reports of Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton, you know, to get in the race. And there are two ways to look at this. On the one hand, you could dismiss these donors as sort of out of touch, too in love with their own sort of pundit-y sense of the world. Democratic voters really like their choices. Polls show the vast majority of Democratic voters are either satisfied or enthusiastic about their choices, you know, at a record level relative to past primary campaigns, right? Or at least tied with like 2008, which was the high point. Or maybe you say, you know what, these are party insiders who have a really good sense of how primaries work and how candidates work. And yeah, Biden isn't an overwhelming front runner. I think a lot of this, frankly, comes down to fear about Warren. Warren is, you know, a kind of clear second in the polls to Biden overall. She leads in many polls of Iowa. So a lot of these donors are looking at the calendar and seeing, oh, if Warren wins Iowa and then New Hampshire, this thing could be over before it really gets started. And then I'm worried, me, Democratic donor, I'm worried that she's going to lose the general election. Maybe I'm also worried that she's going to take some of my money in a tax because I'm a rich, you know, whatever.
Well, the other thing, too, that you see reported is that, well, why wouldn't these donors then just rally around Biden? And you've seen reporting that, well, they've been in the room with him and they don't necessarily see him as having the staying power required. And so basically what you're saying is that Deval Patrick's theory of the case is that the Democratic insiders are right.
Yeah, I think that's right. And he thinks basically that, like, there's a Goldilocks opportunity here where he can kind of square the difference between these different weaknesses as seen from Democratic donors in the current top tier. And then, look, it's like to get more transactions. You know, he thinks, okay, I could do well in neighboring New Hampshire. We know from history that sort of people from that region tend to outperform in the New Hampshire primary. Then maybe I can rally some of the black vote behind me in South Carolina, and then I'm off to the races. There's just no real evidence of that. And I think donors are underrating Biden's strength. I think Biden has some real flaws as a candidate. I think the chances are no better than 50-50 that he wins the nomination. But Biden, like, leads in national polls. He could still win Iowa. He could still win New Hampshire. He leads in Nevada. He leads in South Carolina. Anyway, I'm ranting. Sorry.
All right. Well, we will see what happens. Anyway, listeners, you are likely to see former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick announce his candidacy this week, is the word on the street. Or the reports that we've seen is that he's been telling friends he plans to run and may release a video Thursday or something like that. All right, that's it for Deval Patrick. Amelia, thank you so much for joining us today to cover the opening act of these public impeachment hearings.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
I'm sure there are many more in store.
We'll do
many
it again.
Where that came from.
Friday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday, and then Thursday. It'll be fun.
Micah, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.